Yeah, okay. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us here for this little afternoon of presentation and talks about Technosphärenklänge number 4. So as I said yesterday, the idea of Technosphärenklänge is to inquire into this entanglement of sound, music, and the technosphere of technology and science these days, and also to look into the history of how all of this developed over time. And so, the meaning of those talks is both to give you insight into the actual process of these artistic projects that we are presenting in the series and that we could hear and see yesterday, and also to talk about the history of it. And we will do this, obviously, when Morten Subotnick comes for the second talk. Now, I'd like to welcome you, Valerie Vermeulen, and he is an artist and also a mathematician and sound artist, composer, media artist, and a teacher as well. He teaches at the Art and Technology Department at the Erasmus University College in Brussels, and now he will introduce in a range of projects that he has done over the past few years. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you, Jan, and thank you again, Hakawi and CTM, for having me here. It's really very nice. So today, what I'm going to talk about is on the different projects that I'm elaborating. So as some people might know from yesterday, maybe, or if there were people yesterday, in my work, what I put central is combining music and mathematics. That's a little bit the two red wires throughout also this talk. This talk is meant as to give you a little bit of different ideas, perspectives, how you can combine those two. Of course, it will be done on my own personal experience. So I will go a little bit through the history and also the motivation to combine art and mathematics, where it came from for me personally, and what I think is important if you are working in both fields and look for synergies between the two. So as Jan already told you, originally I started off as being a pure mathematician a long time ago. So you have different kinds of mathematicians. So I come from the field of pure mathematics. I did a PhD, probably you won't see it that well. It's on twin buildings. Probably nobody knows here what twin buildings are, but that's okay, because that's a little bit the world of pure mathematics. It's very abstract. But basically, my PhD was directed in the area of theoretical physics, you could say, in the area of superstring theory. And that's a theory in which people are looking to find a theory in which you can place both Einstein's general relativity theory and the theory of quantum mechanics, because general relativity theory goes is a theory on everything that moves very fast. Quantum physics is a theory that is on everything that's super very little small. And if you have something small moving very fast, as a photon, for example, you need both theories, and they contradict. I mean, till now, nobody has a solution. So if somebody here would have a solution, please let me know. that's a little bit the background in mathematics that I have. After my PhD, because I was at the same time in parallel studying music, piano. So I'm very much into, I was and still are, I'm into piano and vocals. I decided to leave the path as becoming more involved into pure mathematics and try to see if I could combine it with music. So I had the luck to, after my PhD, being able to work as a researcher at the Institute for Psychoacoustics and Electronic Music in my hometown. So I come from Belgium and I live in Ghent. So that's in Ghent also, this institute. And it's a sort of a little IRCAM, you could say. I don't know if people know what IRCAM is. It's in Paris. It's a research, a big research department. This is a little bit a smaller, very small version. I worked there on a research project on music and emotions. So it will come back because it was one of the first real projects that I elaborated in the arts to combine music and mathematics. As to my musical background, that was after working at the IPAM. I lacked I saw that I lacked also some knowledge, some really knowledge on music composition, theory, practice. So that's why I started also studying at the Royal Conservatory in Ghent, the city where I live, and I did there a master's degree in music production, in music composition for pop music. So I'm trained also to produce pop music. So yeah. And in the projects, all the three, I try to get those backgrounds together. This is another facet, a part of the activities that I do. So part of working in the arts. I'm also working partly as a consultant for applied mathematics and statistics and artificial intelligence. So in the beginning, it was really very divided from my artistic work, but now I also found ways to integrate that more and more into my artistic practice. So these are all horrible formulas. Probably you saw them maybe at university or this is all statistical stuff. But it will make sense throughout the talk later on. This is the starting point of combining music and mathematics. That's for me personally. What I try to communicate throughout the various projects that I'm elaborating is that there is no difference between scientific creativity and artistic creativity, especially if you're doing mathematics. It was something that I really experienced during my PhD. So you have a problem that you have to solve. And in order to solve the problem, it's like making a composition. You know, it's like you get stuck, then you have to think, you cannot find the next step in the process, and then all of a sudden it comes into you, and then you use your techniques, your knowledge of mathematics, to solve a part of the problem. And if you're lucky, at the end of the road, you get a whole big problem solved. Now, key is that most people think that mathematics is really very rational, a rational process, because it's the summum of rationality. For me, it is not. Yeah. So it's being a mathematician also means that you have to sort of a way get a sort of an intuition on mathematics, on solving problems that you cannot explain. It's like you have to get it in your veins. It's like if you learn jazz. Yeah, I'm also studying jazz piano. It's the same. You have to first learn all the scales, the modes, the arpeggios, the chord changes. And whenever you have learned all this, you can forget about it and then really start to play music. It's the same with mathematics. So, of course, in our nowadays society, it's a little bit problematic, I think, because, okay, you have the art science. That's people are trying to get those two together. But on the other hand, there is a big it's not a progress for me. Everything is being put into numbers. We see a lot of quantitative models being used in sociology, in econometrics, in medicine also, in the Internet of Things. I mean, a lot of things are coming to us, and it's really very weird for me to see as a mathematician that people rely on very computational models that reduce reality to numbers. So that's the other evolution that we're heading towards. And this is also an inspiration for a later work that I will talk about. These are two influences and two works. I just mentioned them that influenced me a lot in the beginning and still till today. I don't know if somebody know who those people are. Probably not. Those are mathematicians and a philosopher. So the left is Kurt Gödel. He was a mathematician living in the beginning of the 20th century. And why is he important? He was one of the most important mathematicians. He's also very important for artificial intelligence, Kurt Gödel. He proved his incompleteness theorem in the 20s of the beginning of the former century. And what is the incompleteness theorem? So in the 19th century, there was a whole evolution, positivism in mathematics. And you had a German mathematician, Hilbert, and he put out a program called Hilbert's program. And the core idea that people had at that time on mathematics was that To do science and mathematics and physics and chemistry, you just have to have the right kind of axioms for a system. You have to have the right kind of rules to see the processes, how they evolve. And whenever you have those two, the descriptions and the rules, you can derive and describe the system completely, completely deterministically, 100%. So if Hilbert would have been correct, it would have meant that computers now would be able to talk, to have emotions, to, I mean, but we know that it's not the case. And it's a little bit thanks to Gödel. He proved in the 20th, it was really a collapse in mathematics. It was a disaster for mathematicians. It was also a good evolution. But Kurt Gödel, he could prove basically that if you take something simple as the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you have 0, and you have the operation of adding two numbers together, so 3 plus 4 is 7, if Hilbert would have been correct, you could describe it using, first, define what a number is, the object, and then define the rules. And if you have that system, you could derive the whole theory, mathematical theory on the numbers, using those rules. So all the mathematics that you can write and deduce about natural numbers would have been solved. Kurt Gödel, he proved in his famous incompleteness theorem that it's not true. It's not possible to make a simple mathematical formal structure to describe something simple as natural numbers. What is the implication for today? The implication is that this machine, computer or laptop, whatever, cannot understand what real numbers are. It's impossible because of Kurt Gödel. So it's also, of course, used a lot in a debate about the point of singularity in artificial intelligence that people are talking a lot about. So for me, why is that important? Because if you read the proof, you really come up to the boundaries of mathematics and of rational thinking. You see the distinction between the mathematical world and the real world. Kurt Gödel shows that there's really a gap that can never be closed. So reality, here you have reality, and here you have mathematics. And it's on top of reality. It's not describing completely reality. And as an artist, it's the same. As an artist, what you do, you try to give an interpretation, your interpretation of reality. And of course, it's not completely reality. Otherwise, it's not artistic. I mean, it's not art for me. So that's a very important work for me. And the other is, that's Wittgenstein, if you ever have time. So he wrote the Tractatus, maybe some under you know that. Why are they just in juxtaposition to each other? Wittgenstein proved the same thing as Gödel, but for language. He used similar techniques. I mean, it's not a mathematical proof, but he also proved that with language you can describe reality, but you cannot grasp complete reality. So, yeah, it's also very important for artificial intelligence, for further evolution. So, for me, those works were had a very big impact on my work as an artist and a mathematician also. So now I will come to three concrete projects in which I combined mathematical techniques and music. The first is called EmoSynth. This is a project that we started. I talk about we because it was a group effort already 10 years ago. And the idea of EmoSynth came a little bit because of my work at the Institute, at the Institute for Psychoacoustics and Electronic Music. The idea was, this is still an idea that I have till today, it can be further elaborated, to have an automatically generating music generating system that can automatically generate, in this case, soundtracks that adapt themselves to your emotional state. So with EmoSynth, we were looking to break with the paradigm of even streaming services like Deezer or iTunes or whatever, to really have personalized systems that can generate personalized music, especially made for you, that can direct you towards a certain kind of emotional state. So if you
prolong that to the further evolution, it would mean you would skip iTunes, you would skip Deezer. You would have a sort of a computational, a little composer inside your computer that could make a version of your favorite track. And one day maybe you want to have a metal version of it, or you want to have a remix, or you have want to have a version that gets you in this kind of emotional state or that kind of emotional state. So that's the whole idea behind EmoSynth. With EmoSynth, we worked on prototypes towards that direction. It was a project which was also funded by the Flemish government, so we got a grant, and it was a team effort. So I worked with several people on this project, because it's a lot of different aspects and angles that you have to attack doing such a project. Now, how does EmoSynth work? I don't have it with me for the moment. So it's a system, it works with biosensors, biofeedback. So everybody probably knows nowadays we all have them in our smartphones, and they're coming more and more. And those are sensors that measure parameters such as heart rate, your stress level, even your brain waves, which is very easy to do nowadays. And the system, first you have to train it. It is an artificial intelligence system. So during the training phase, you will try to make the EmoSynth get you in four different kind of emotional states. The first state is also a very important note here is something on emotion psychology. In emotion psychology, emotions are classified using a valence component. So an emotion can be positive or negative, and an arousal component, that's the intensity of the emotion. Now, if you take those two dimensions, for example, an emotion with a positive valence and a high arousal is happiness. An emotion with a positive valence and a low arousal would be if you're really zen, you're really at ease. A negative with a high arousal is anger, for example. Now, with the normal biosensors, it's only possible to measure the arousal component, the intensity, not the valence. So don't believe what people say, or products tend to say, yeah, we can measure your full emotional spectrum using just simple biosensors from your smartphone. It's not possible. Only the arousal component. For this project, we had four categories of arousal. So low arousal, emotions with a little bit higher arousal, emotions with even higher arousal, and emotions with really high arousal. So for the EmoSynth to get to work, you train it to yourself. So you take biosensors, you couple it to the EmoSynth. It works with heart rate and stress level measuring devices. And you train it. The EmoSynth will try to get you in four stages. So it will generate generative music using algorithms to first get you in a low aroused state. And it's a sort of an intelligent search process. I will also come back to that later shortly. It tries, and after a while, it finds the right kind of music to make you at ease. Once that's trained, it's saved as a sort of an emotional response profile inside the computer. As a next part, the EmoSynth will try to get you in a rather low aroused state, the next state. Okay, once that's done, again, saved in the computer. For the rather high aroused state, save the computer, and for the really aroused state, also trained and saved inside the computer. After those four stages, we have a sort of we call it an emotional response profile, specially made for you, that knows what music the EmoSynth has to generate to get you in those four stages. Once you have done this, you take a movie, you cut it into scenes that you have to do as yourself, if you want to use the system. You cut those scenes into parts, and you have to annotate every scene. So you have to say, for this scene, I want the EmoSynth to make me in a low aroused state. For this scene, here is a murderer. I really want the EmoSynth to get me like in a high aroused state. Once you've done this, you load the movie inside the system. You have the emotional response profile, and the EmoSynth starts. You press start, and the EmoSynth starts playing the movie. Emosyn comes to the first video clip. It knows I have to make the person calm down. It's a low arousal state. I know I have to use this this model, response model. I have to make this kind of music. Comes to the next video clip. This is a high arousal state. It has to generate another kind of music. Uses again this response profile, and etc. And in this way, you get a whole automatically generated soundtrack which has a maximal emotional impact for the person who is trained to the system. So that's a little bit how it works. To elaborate such a project, you need a different kind of techniques. I was inspired by a book which is called Creative Evolutionary Systems. If you have the chance, it's super interesting. It's a book about how to create with a computer systems that can complement or simulate human creativity using Darwinistic rules, Darwinistic systems from artificial intelligence. So that's one part. The other part that we were using, this is not a Furby, it looks like a Furby, but it's a different one. This is a robot, an effective robot it's called. It's from the MIT Museum in the States. And this comes out of the field of effective computing. Maybe you heard about it, effective computing. It's almost over 20 years. It's from 94, the first book appeared. And effective computing is basically trying to make a connection between man and machine using emotions. One of the pioneers, if you want to read a good book about it, there's a book called Effective Computing by Professor Rosalinde Picard, a professor at MIT, and she started the whole movement, the whole idea of effective. Well, it goes back, of course, there's other traces more deeper in history, but that's the first time that the book was, the term was used in a real academic setting. So we were also using techniques from the field of effective computing in Emosynt. This is the algorithms, the technique for the training that we were using in the system. It's called genetic programming, and it's a sort of an optimization technique using the rules of Darwin. So to explain it, so you see here birds. I always explain it with like birds and a forest. So let's say that the Emosynt has to make you, train and learn which kind of music it has to generate to get you in a low aroused state. What will happen is you have to compare it to you're walking in a woods, in a forest with all kinds of birds. All those birds sing different songs, and all those birds, they correspond to the different response, emotional response models. The first bird sings his or her song to you. The Emosynt sees using the biofeedback sensors how your body reacts to the music. If the bird has a good effect, makes you calm down, the bird gets a fitness rate, how healthy it is in the forest. So a bird that does his or her job well will get a high fitness function. It's very healthy. The next bird sings its song, the same process is repeated, the next, etc., until the whole forest, all the birds sing their song. And then there's, as nature evolves, there's a new population of birds coming into the forest, replacing the older birds. And then the rules of Darwin are valid. What are the rules of Darwin? So I try to draw it a little bit in a cartoonish way. Birds that do not do their job well, so that sing songs and you're really not calm down, they die. And they're replaced by birds coming from another forest. That's the first rule. The second rule is birds can, you have to you can compare that, suppose there's a nuclear plant somewhere in the forest. If birds come too close, hey, we have it in Belgium, we have a lot of nuclear plants. and everybody tries to put them, you know, to the boundary of the country. So whenever birds come too close to the nuclear plant, they undergo a mutation. So all of a sudden, in the next generation, their feathers color changes, or their beak, or something else. So that's a mutation. And the last is there's also a crossover. So there's a possibility whenever you have in the forest, whenever you have two birds, that they meet each other and that they get two children. It's programmed in Emosynth that the two children will replace the parents and they will get properties of the parents. And using these principles, you get evolution after evolution after evolution. And hopefully, after a while, you get a forest with all birds singing songs that make you calm down. So that's a little bit how it works. And it's not a technical explanation that I'm giving, but that would take us much too far. Yeah. So as already said, biofeedback, that's the whole science of using biosensors to measure your emotional reactions. It's also very important in Emosynth. This was a performance a long time ago that we did here in Berlin, in Liebigstrasse 12. This is like a functional diagram, because point with Emosynth now, as it is now, I have the system in my house, it's getting older and older. I mean, the next step would be to have a new version of Emosynth, but in meanwhile I did other projects. For now, it's an offline learning system. You learn it, and then you train it, and you can use it to make soundtracks. In the next generation, it would be good to have a system that at the same time generates and learns. That's the next step. And that's where the contemporary artificial intelligence evolution also is heading towards. But it puts a lot of new paradigms, also technical on the programming level. It's not so easy to do that. But that's the ideal goal of Emosynth. You have your subject with his or her emotion, hopefully. Emosynth generates image sound, goes to the subject with the emotion, is being measured using the biosensors. You have psychophysiological response. Those are the responses correlated to the emotions, being fed back into Emosynth, and you get a feedback loop. And in the ideal situation, the feedback loop, the Emosynth will get smarter and smarter and smarter, the more the feedback loop is like iterated, and after a while, the Emosynth knows exactly what to do. Of course, I don't have to tell you, working on such projects, well, when we started 10 years ago, it was also clear. You get new interesting paradigms, new interesting boundaries that are being broken between audience, artist, and the music in this case that's being generated. Because am I the composer? Because I designed the algorithm that generates music? Or is the person who's sitting using the system, is he or she the composer? Who is the audience of the whole system? So is the computer also part of the audience or not? So it all gets very blurry and interesting. To give you an idea, of course, I was not the first to work with biosensors. The first performance ever, probably you know it, you can find it if you Google it on YouTube, with biosensors was done by Alvin Lucier in 1965. And he still does these performances, Alvin Lucier. It's called Music for Solo Performer. It's with a brainwave scanner, which was like in 65, it was custom made. Nowadays, you can buy a headset to measure your brainwaves for $150. So, yeah, but at that time, it was another era. I will show you a small excerpt, because I'm talking about Emosynth, it's all abstract, how it sounds and how it looks. For Emosynth, I have to say, for the music generation, there's three sources that it can use. It can generate MIDI notes, so I think everybody knows here what MIDI is. It can also mix audio loops that you put into the system, and it can also generate live scores. And those scores are used to direct live musicians, because I didn't want the Emosynth to be a purely digital system in which I would do a performance, sit behind a laptop and press spacebar and that's it. There's also musicians playing along. It's also nicer for the audience, because what we would do with the performances, we would invite people to be trained to the system, and then after a day or two, we would do the performance, and then an audience would come see and watch the Emocent perform the music for this special person that was trained to the Emocent. So I will show you a short excerpt from the project. The movie that was used here is The Phantom of the Opera of Julian Rupert. So to make it in an artistic setting, we mostly used black and white mute movies, because you have the clash between very old movies and then new technology, artificial intelligence. So. And there's different styles of music. Here is a jazz version, kind of version of yours. So this was a part in which Emocent was trying to make the person at a low aroused state. Now, towards the end of The Phantom of the Opera, if you know the story, it's about a phantom, of course, in an opera, who abducted the daughter of the owner, I think, of the opera. And yeah, towards the end, a crowd is following the phantom. You see, the music gets more like agitated and more faster, and with more. There's also the synth loops playing in the background. The drums are being directed by the computer using headphones that give cues to the drummer. Okay, so the next project I'm going to talk about shortly is Micromera. So that was a project with which I did the performance yesterday. So that's another topic. Micromeras is basically using astrophysical data, and now it's also astrophysical simulation models coming from quantum gravity to make music. That's a little bit the idea. It started as a commissioned work for a Dutch Electronic Arts Festival, a Biennale in Rotterdam in 2014. And they commissioned the work because they had a theme on space, and they commissioned the work on space and sound. So that was basically the commission. I was really thinking about, because I was still working with Emocent, and I said, okay, I didn't know exactly how to handle the topic. And then I stumbled up the field of data sonification. It's a scientific domain in which people are using sound and sometimes music to represent data. Why would you do that? It has been proven that if you have a multimedial, if you use as well vision as sound to represent the data, it gives more information as a researcher. You get more insight into certain kind of scientific questions also than if you only look at the data. And also sonifying data, transforming it into sound, can bring certain patterns that you would otherwise never see. That's a very interesting domain. Of course, whenever there is a scientific domain as such, there is a very fast, there are also artists seeing if they can hack it and use it for their artistic purpose, and that's what happened with data sonification. And that's also what I started to use for Emocent. So there is basically two kinds of data sonification you can use. So the first are the sonifications that were being done by NASA and ESA. Those are also the ones that I'm using. So what happened there was they sent Voyager satellites, for example, into space. Now they're into deep space in the end of the 70s. And they record electromagnetic radiation. It's something like radio waves being emitted by all kind of astrophysical objects. Of course, there's no sound in space and you cannot hear those electromagnetic waves, but you can transform them into the sonic fields. And that's what happened with all those data being recorded by Voyager and NASA. And all those data streams are available. So you can use them, those streams, to make music. The other part in data sonification, you can really use numbers. Really numbers, and then you have to design your own synthesizers, your own techniques to transform them into sound. And if you do that, you make, for me it's very interesting because you make a direct, very direct connection between mathematics, designing the own synths, designing your own sonification techniques. It becomes part of the composition process and the music and the composition process. So it's a very direct way. So yeah, and then you have to use programs like Max or Pure Data or Processing, or there's more and more such programs coming on. Sometimes you can also use, this is R for people who are into statistics. This is a really very dry scientific program, but I have the luck to having worked and have a lot of experience with this because I'm working already over 15 years as a consultant applied mathematics. So, and now I also start using these programs to make art. The series yesterday, so for Micromedas, there's two series, and yesterday the series that I played is called OGLE 2005 BLG 319 LB. It's a horrible title for an album. But it's the title. I cannot help it. The name, if you Google it, it's the name of an exoplanet. And an exoplanet is a planet that looks like Earth, and it's an exoplanet that is in the vicinity 1,000 light years from the center of our Milky Way. So it is at a distance of approximately 21,000 light years from Earth, from here. And this series, this series is about a voyage from Earth to this exoplanet. So what I wanted to do with this series as an artist, try to, using sound, give a sort of an impression what it would mean to undertake this voyage. Of course, there's no sound in space, but I'm not a visual artist, and I'm interested if you can do that using sound. And that's what I was playing yesterday at the concert. Of course, there's a lot of... it's very funny. The further away you get from our planet Earth, the less data you have, and the more abstract the data becomes. As an example of data sonification, you can check it up. There's also very interesting work by Alexander, a scientist, and he could devise new things about the sun using sonification that are also being used in the Micromedas project. Now the second series, that's the next series that we're preparing, is the ADS CFT series. So if somebody's interested, I have a book here. it's on quantum gravity. So quantum gravity, as I said in the beginning, and that's where the beginning comes together, also the research in my PhD. It's trying to combine general relativity theory with quantum theory, quantum mechanics. And there's a lot of new evolutions going on. Scientists are really made a lot of progress, and one of the most exciting fields is the ADS-CCFT theory. It's the abbreviation of the anti-de Sitter conformal field theory, but I mean, yeah, of course, nobody has something on it. Basically, what it states is we live in physics, we live not in a three-dimensional, but in a four-dimensional world, because we have time and three space dimensions. The idea is just if you have something that you want to describe in our world with four dimensions that is too difficult, then physicists in this theory, they go over to sort of a flatland. A flatland with two spatial dimensions and one time dimensions. And what they discovered, it was discovered in 97, is we can solve those difficult problems in our world here in flatland in a much easier way. And so they transport it to flatland, they solve it there, and then they can come back with this theory in reality. And then they have solved very complicated problems. And it can lead to a way to solve the problem of unifying quantum mechanics and relativity theory. Now, the idea for this series is to use models from this theory, data from this theory, to make a whole concert series out of it. So it's scheduled for the next year, 2018. So these are drawings. This is conceptual representation. A lot of people, luckily, also from the Netherlands involved. So it's not far away from where I live in Belgium. The last project I'm going to shortly talk about that has another angle combining music and mathematics is called Crystal Ball. And this project, the theme, it's more a political project, you could say. The core idea is it's a little bit about my the misuse of mathematical models in all kind of industries and our societies that we see nowadays, putting everything into numbers. And the very good example, of course, is the world of Wall Street, the world of banking. So high-frequency trading. We saw it in 2008. We had this enormous crash, and there will be a next crash, I mean, for sure, because it's cyclical. But if you look at the idea, and that's typical for a whole neoliberal society, that everything is being put onto numbers, everything has to be efficient, everything has to be put into the value. It's very important, monetary value. What I learned, because I studied also some mathematical models from financial industry, also the history, if you steal 3 billion euros, don't steal an apple, because if you steal an apple, you will be put into jail. But if you steal 3 million euros, you won't be put into jail, you know, you can get away with it. So, and basically what banks do with the mathematics is just, you have risk models, financial risk models, as we know. Banks do not have all the money that we have on our bank accounts, because if we get all our money, the bank is broke. And they have to have a sort of a risk models, they call it, financial risk models. And those risk models, they simulate a little bit how we behave. What the risk is that everybody gets the money, and also what the risks are coupled to all the money that the bank loans to other people. And those models are very beautiful from a mathematical point of view. It's based on game theory. There's a lot of also techniques from theoretical physics being used there. But if you look at it from a mathematical point of view, it's okay. But in reality, it does not describe reality. It's not reality. And that's the trick what the banks are doing. Then they say, yeah, but you have to trust us because we have an army of 100 engineers who made all those very complicated models, and they say there is no risk. And it happens everywhere, more and more in other domains. We see the same problem and situations also with artificial intelligence. I see it also. I sometimes work for insurance companies. There you see the same thing going on, everything being put into numbers, risk models for insurance policies, etc. Nuclear plants, the same problem, risk models based on theoretical models that are very beautiful in a mathematical world but have nothing to do with reality. So that's a little bit on that. And the idea is just for that to use techniques from Wall Street to start to compose music. You need algorithmic music composition techniques. This is like a visual version of it. You can also do visuals with it, of course. I'm going to shortly go over. Algorithmic composition was used a long time. Also, Mozart used it, for example. David Bowie, Low, which was produced here in Berlin. Also used algorithmic composition. And of course, very important for me is the work with Crystal Ball, the work of Yannis Xenakis. If you don't know him, very interesting to check it out. He is a French-Greek composer who is using really hardcore mathematics in the 60s to compose beautiful pieces that have really a very big value and meaning. And this is a very famous piece, Phytotrichia, by Xenakis. He didn't have computers. He has scientific paper. But it's using statistics. Here you see the parameters of the statistics to compose a piece. So I'll end with these are, if you want more information about those projects, of course, I have a website. This is my email. And for Micromeras, there's a group on Facebook. So if you want to hear more about it, just check it out and subscribe. And that's my Twitter account. So I don't know if there are any questions about all the topics, the projects that I talked about. Yes. A lot of different. There's a lot of pop music also. But to put names on it. Now I'm also influenced by jazz, for example, Bill Evans, if you know. Yes, it's also a big influence for me. Into pop, I'm also the boundary of pop music, like Ryuichi Ikeda, for example. Yeah, of course, I like it a lot. But also people like Grimes or Holly Herndon, or I mean, that's also very interesting for me, or St. Vincent, if you know. Yeah. So it's very broad, you know, jazz, pop music, but also the experimental music. Yeah. Also Xenakis, of course, that's also for me. It's an eye opener. Yeah.
It's really interesting because when I think of people like St. Vincent and Grimes, who are part of, like, the borderline of the pop world, what is it that appeals their music to you as a mathematician?
I'm also a musician, of course. I mean, I worked also, that I didn't talk about, in pop music world, so, but I don't talk about it here. What I find interesting of St. Vincent and Grimes is that they have an interesting way to present and to produce their work. I mean, there's songs and there's nice songs. I mean, you can make good, great songs. That's important to have good harmony. I believe in good harmony, good melodies, good vocals. But they do something new, you know. It's not like following, because we see it a lot. You have one artist who has success, especially in dance music. I was working a little bit in dance music. One person has a success with a track and everybody follows. So, and it's, for me, it's not interesting, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, I think because they try to express and look for boundaries and try to cross it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much for the interesting talks. Coming from a little bit of a technical perspective about the, because I've been thinking about similar things connecting music and emotions. And
yes.
One of the first issues we came up struggling with was that a lot of the psychophysiological measures, like cardiometric, for example, they have a high variance over time, some of them. Some behave better, and others, like skin conductance, for example, are very sensitive to laboratory conditions and stuff. And that connection with many of the machine learning models and the models you talked about being sensitive to noise. How could you arrange the these two issues to make it such a beautiful music that we heard?
It's the algorithm. The music generating algorithm, it's a statistical model with a lot of different parameters, and all those parameters are trained using the biosensors. But of course, I know there's a lot of noise. So very important is the calibration. We took a lot of effort to make a good calibration of the person. So heart rate, that is good calibrated for this person. Also the stress level. also for the training. You have a certain setting that has to be respected. And of course, I'm realistic. I'm very happy if I can have 30% of effect, you know, I know, or 20%. Don't believe any company or a provider who would say, we can completely direct you with 80%. That's not possible. Of course, there's a lot of, they call it covariates, and it's, that's the case. But from a statistical point of view, 20% would already be a great, great deal to have that effect. Yeah. I forgot that. Yeah. Yes. From the crystal ball, eh? Here is the audio. I'm gonna try this one. Of course, with the Micromiras project, I have my own techniques in the studio that I'm using that I like. And of course, if somebody else would do the same procedure, it would give different kind of textures and different sounds. So, yeah. These were, well, what I happened here was a certain kind of models I don't know if it's here that I did it. I was using Black-Scholes risk model to trigger notes and to trigger certain events in the track. Yeah. So I programmed those models, those statistical triggers, and they can trigger melodies, they can trigger pitches, or they can trigger rhythms. And of course, the sounds that are being triggered mostly are designed. I design those sounds. It's a little bit of a combination between the two. But it would be nice, and that's also what I'm looking with Micromeras. I mean, Micromeras and Crystal Ball are a little bit now coming together, because I'm using the techniques sometimes for both more, to also have an influence on the sound generation itself, the synthesis. That's now what I'm looking. That's the next level. And I'm looking how to design sound spaces, like you have now the two-dimensional sound spaces, but I would need four-dimensional sound spaces, for example, for the Micromeras project. Yeah. So, go deeper and deeper into the sound itself. Yeah.
But you did not try to sonify the actual data stream produced by the activities on the stock market and so on.
No,
I mean, it has been done by some.
It has been done so many times, and I was like, yeah, what can I add to that? Yeah, I'm more thinking from the Xenakis point of perspective, like build your own mathematical models that generate data, and then use that data. Yeah. But of course, you can also So thank you again for